Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. We're talking to leaders across the cell and gene therapy industry and telling you more about Ori's mission to manufacture brighter futures. I'm Jason Foster, the CEO of Ori Biotech, and I'll be the host for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Ori Spotlight Podcast. This week, we're lucky enough to have Jeff and Adam from LEK Consulting. Jeff Holder and Adam Siebert head up their life sciences / cell and gene therapy practices. And most of you know who LEK Consulting is, but I thought we might just start there with a little bit more about each of you, how you got to this point in your careers, and what you guys are up to at LEK that's relevant for cell and gene. Should we start with Adam?
Sure, happy to. First, thanks for having us, Jason. So as Jason indicated, I am a partner in LEK Consulting within our life sciences enablers practice, and we'll get into that in a bit more detail as we go through the conversation. But I started my career as a scientist, as a cell biologist. And really, my path to that was a little bit more winding. I did not necessarily know exactly what I wanted to do. And so I started off first working for a pharma company and realized that all the people that had interesting jobs had more initials after their names. So I knew I needed to go back to school for something. And science has always been something that made sense to me and was something that I was interested and passionate in. And so decided to go back to school for a PhD in cell biology, and knowing full well that I never wanted to stay within academic research as a career choice. So as soon as I started in grad school, I was already looking for other perhaps non-traditional career paths, and consulting was one that I felt kept the most doors open as I think about kind of the overall trajectory and pathway to a career. So that's what I really pursued as towards the latter part of my graduate school training, and was fortunate enough to get an offer from LEK. So I've spent the last 10 years working within their life sciences practice, first within kind of the biopharma side of things, helping biopharma companies think about their R&D portfolios and strategies, as well as their corporate strategies. But within the last 5 years, transitioned over to what we call the life sciences enablers, which colloquially we think of as anything that a biopharma company buys. That's kind of the what we work in. And so the major areas there are life science research tools, diagnostics and precision medicine, biopharma manufacturing and supply chain, and then overall pharma services. And I spend most of my time within the biopharma manufacturing supply chain with a pretty big emphasis in the advanced therapeutic modalities. So cell therapies, gene therapies, nucleic acid medicines, and then also into some of the more advanced biologics with bispecifics, ADCs, radiopharmaceuticals, et cetera. So that's kind of where I spend a lot of my time, really passionate and about how we make these innovative and novel therapies more accessible. And you know, there's a lot of the conversation later today that we're going to get into about making, you know, reducing COGS, making a more streamlined process, et cetera, that I think are, you know, essential for how we think about this industry going forward.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And I wouldn't say it's that non-traditional for people to go into a PhD and figure out about halfway through that they don't want to be in the lab for the rest of their lives. So I think that's...
Yeah, I think increasingly that's the case. And it's a good pathway and a good, I guess, direction that we're heading in, just because it's not feasible to stay within academia. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's important to have that scientific training and rigor in the business world, particularly in biopharma. So, and I loved you calling it enabling technologies. You know, everyone says, oh, you're a tools business. I'm like, no, we're an enabling technologies business. It's a totally different thing. It used to be that tools like, oh, tools, you know, it's not therapeutics, it's tools. But as we've learned in advanced therapies in particular, these platforms are taking on greater and greater importance as we move forward to commercialization, which we'll talk a lot more about. Can you tell us a bit more about LEK? I mean, most people know you guys, but it'd probably be worthwhile just describing the firm a little bit before we get down to the details.
Sure. So LEK is a global strategy management consulting firm. We started 40 years ago, so we're actually celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. As a spin out from Bain in London. And obviously over the past 40 years, we've grown quite a bit. I think we have, you know, over 2000 folks on staff, over 200 partners as well. And this spans all industries and sectors. So we are a generalist firm. That being said, healthcare with a capital H is kind of our biggest sector. And within that, it again spans a variety of stuff, right? We have healthcare services, payer provider, we have med tech, and then life sciences. And as I alluded to in my initial question or answer, the life sciences biopharma is really helping biopharma companies, you know, think through their strategies over a broad portfolio of areas, right? In terms of either corporate strategy, R&D, portfolio strategies, go-to-market strategies, et cetera. And then what Jeff and I do, which is the enablers. So we are tackling some of the same strategic issues across the different sectors and companies. It's just in my own vernacular, it's asking the same questions just with a different vocabulary, right? We're not necessarily thinking about, you know, what's the best, you know, which drug program should we be taking forward? It's instead, you know, which use case for our novel technology should we be prioritizing and should we really be thinking about, how to take that to market and who to go after. So it's, again, similar questions, just different vocabulary. Within the life sciences enablers, we do have four other partners that are leading it. Alex Vadas and Zhang are the senior partners that have really built this practice up from the ground. And then Tian Han and Matt Wheeler as well are the other two partners that are within this practice. We also do have a staff of about 50 to 60 consulting professionals that support us, and they are dedicated to this space. So as much passion as Jeff and I have for this area, I would say that that our colleagues who are working on these projects within the consulting staff, they share that same passion and energy, which really helps out a lot as we think about the complexities within the space, that they can really hit the ground running and already have an incoming knowledge base that they can build off of to really, you know, get to the implications and insights sooner than later for the projects.
Well, that's great background on LEK as well. And, you know, maybe we can start off, if you don't mind, just giving us a flavor of the kinds of projects that you guys get called into, you know, types of clients. You know, I'm guessing biopharma is a big customer. I'm guessing some of the CDMOs, potentially other service providers, other technology companies. Like, give me a sense of some of the kinds of challenges that your clients are engaging you with and that you guys are thinking about on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, so I would say that we have, at the highest level, we have the transaction support that we're supporting either private equity clients or even, you know, more industry clients with or strategic clients with capital raises or divestitures or M&A activity. Mm-hmm. And we support both the buy side and the sell side on those types of projects. But then on the, I guess, on the strategic side, with actual, you know, biopharma customers or the tools and aggregators parts of the business, we do support the major aggregators, the Danahers, Thermos of the world. We also get into kind of the emerging or tools players, or I know we said tools earlier as more.
Yeah, we banned tools from this podcast. Sorry.
Can't use that. That's right.
enabling technology players.
You know, innovative or enabling technologies, that's right, that supply into the workflows for cell and gene therapies or other modalities. We also, you know, help equipment manufacturers, again, that are supplying into this space. And then from a manufacturing standpoint, we do support both CDMOs or CTDMOs, depending on, you know, how deep into the world of contract services we want to go. And then also biopharma on the CMC and manufacturing organization and quality organization. We're doing a lot of projects right now helping biopharma companies think through their manufacturing strategies, right? What are they producing? Are they doing it in-house? Are they outsourcing it? What parts are they outsourcing? With whom are they partnering for that activity? And I guess the second piece of that is, given that there's a lot of biopharma companies that have their own internal manufacturing facility, what should we do with that internal manufacturing facility, right? There's been, at least over the past, you know, year, 2 years, there's been a lot of holds or delays in biopharma program development programs, some clinical failures as well. And so a a lot of companies have a large fixed costs on their hands when it comes to a manufacturing facility, and they want to know what they should be doing with it. So there's a lot of strategic options and discussions around the value of that facility, and especially as when we compare to outsourcing to a CDMO right now.
I was going to say they're seeing the lines blur a bit as well. So we saw Novartis contract with J&J Legends, on Carvykti manufacturing. They had some capacity in their, I think it was a Moores Plains facility. So they're not only manufacturing their own products, but also acting as a CDMO for other partners. It was kind of an interesting strategic shift, I think, for a lot of the big pharma players.
Yeah, it's an interesting shift. There's a lot of complexity around that, right? There's a lot of complexity in terms of the walls between the internal and the external programs and the sharing of IP. There's mm-hmm. a lot of discussion around the suitability of a biopharma manufacturing facility to then transition to being a CDMO facility that can take on, the complexity of not only multiple programs, but also, the needs of each program are going to be very, very different. And so how quickly can we turn around a suite, and how universal is a suite for a variety of different programs that may be quite different from each other? I think the other piece that is really challenging is how do we fill that capacity, right? Because it takes a long time for an asset to move through to later clinical stages or even commercial, where really the demand is going to be significant. And so how do we get the earlier stage assets into the facility, and how do we compete against the more established CDMOs that may already have a track record here? So it's a very complex question on how do we fill it, and I think a lot of people are still trying to figure this out as we go.
Jeff, love to give you a chance to just introduce your background a little bit, and then want to invite you into this conversation around, it's kind of heading into this buy or build discussion. I think there's been, we've seen a lot of companies maybe 4 or 5 years ago want to build out and own their own capacity. And I can name 6 or 7 of them that have subsequently, once they built that capacity out, taken it and then sold it on, because they realized actually, utilizing that capacity is a totally different game than what they're used to in drug development. So if you don't mind, just give me a quick intro on yourself. And then if you care to weigh in on that topic, this kind of buy or build decision that's facing a lot of early stage cell and gene therapy companies.
Sure, absolutely. Jeff Holder, I'm a partner and managing director at LEK, based out of the San Francisco office. Much like Adam, my path to consulting was far from a straight line. It was a bit of a random walk, if I'm being honest. Never had a laser-focused idea of what I wanted to do with my career. Was always interested in medicine and technology and innovation in medicine. I come from a family of doctors and nurses, but I wasn't really cut out for medical school. I cannot stand the sight of blood, so that was never really in the cards for me. I studied chemistry in college because I liked the idea of building things and putting molecules together. Kind of probably grew out of my interest in Legos as a kid. And I came to really appreciate the challenge of drug discovery through the small molecule lens, through my coursework, through industry interactions at conferences. Did an internship at Eli Lilly as a medicinal chemist. And I became to just really think about those bigger picture questions about how do we pick targets? How do we address undruggable targets? What do we do in indications where we don't have drugs today? How do we think about portfolio strategy? Kind of came to appreciate that these were these big strategic questions that I wanted to wrestle with a career. And I didn't really have any idea how to do that in a traditional academic path or in a traditional go work at as a research scientist path. So I had a friend from graduate school who was at this firm called LEK Consulting at the time. She told me that her job was interviewing world-leading KOLs and thinking about cutting-edge topics and helping advise innovative companies on growth strategies. And I thought that sounded amazing, but I didn't know the first thing about business. As somebody very grounded in science and chemistry. So I started, reading up on Harvard Business Review articles, books, practice case interviews, joined the consulting club, all of that. And with a lot of practice, I was fortunate enough to get an offer here at LEK. And my path here has been a confluence of both my interest vectors in precision medicine, innovative science, making drugs the ecosystem of enabling technologies and processes and services around drugs, And a little bit of the right time and right place that when I started was really the explosion of the cell and gene therapy space. Had the great fortune to work on some landmark M&A and business development deals during my early years, and really snowballed that into an area of expertise and a career vector. So really fortunate to be as deep in the space as we have the opportunity to be today with our exposure and the projects and clients that we support.
That's great. Thanks for that background. And Adam had covered a bit about the types of clients and work that you guys are doing. I wonder if you could weigh in on this discussion about, I know, you know, many people, certainly many companies, as they hit closer to commercialization, want to be in control of their own manufacturing capacity. But it's a long and torturous road, as we know, to commercialization. And I wonder kind of what the current thinking is around this buy or build. And we were at the Alliance for Regenerative Medicine meeting, it was early October, I think it was, out in Carlsbad. And there was something like 43 cell and gene therapy CDMOs there. I mean, it was an explosion of that kind of that part of the market and the service providers there, which signals to me that, you know, this kind of these service providers are seeing an opportunity that, you know, maybe companies don't want to own their own capacity or build their own capacity out as early as they might have done 4 or 5 years ago. But I don't know if that's an accurate reading of the situation or what your view is.
Yeah, thanks, Jason. It's a really good question. And I do think that the dynamic has changed over the past 4 or 5 years, certainly over the last 2 years, as the funding environment and the macroeconomic environment has changed. Let's take ourselves back 5, 6 years ago. There's a lot more white space in the market. The dynamic was speed really at all costs to get to market, to get through clinical trials first, particularly in prevalence-driven indications. There was this view that not only does first mover convey significant advantage, but potentially first takes most if you are treating and removing addressable patients from that prevalent pool. For example, in rare monogenic diseases for viral vector gene therapy, there was very much a first takes most attitude, and that dynamic drove speed at all costs as the development goal. So we were taking effectively academic processes, trying to commercialize them, trying to get them into patients as fast as possible. So there was tremendous strategic value in owning your own capacity and really controlling your destiny from a clinical timeline perspective. Mm-hmm. Again, remember, there weren't that many CDMOs 5, 6 years ago either that could really say with a straight face that they had supported a GMP process or a clinical trial, let alone any sort of regulatory approval. And yeah, those players had an 18 plus month wait for a suite. So there was a significant amount of getting in line very early. And there was a significant amount of, for the players who had access to capital, the decision to build, to control their own destinies, and strategic insourcing of supply was a big piece of controlling that clinical destiny. Mm. So I think that was the scenario 5, 6 years ago. Now there's kind of two trends that I see. One is more recognition of the value of thinking through manufacturing and developing a more robust, scalable, if you will, or commercially viable manufacturing process. So we like to talk a lot about the GMP-ification of the preclinical space and kind of drifting earlier in the value chain to these considerations of process and scale and cost efficiency and COGS. So there's that on one hand as a push or a pull, and then the access to capital and the funding situation is materially different. It's much harder to raise money. It's much harder to justify the capital expenditure of a facilities build out, particularly if you're ahead of any meaningful proof of concept clinical data. That's a big risk for a small company to take that on. But we saw plenty of companies do that 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Not the case anymore. So I think those are the push and pull dynamics that are changing the buyer build dynamic. And then there's a bigger question. I'll kick this one to Adam about the role of the CDMO, and obviously there's been some we can call it less than favorable headlines for some CDMOs. A lot of Form 483s being thrown around, and some pretty high profile missteps by some CDMOs and CRO partners in the advanced modality space. So there's a push and a pull of these cost factors of the who do you trust, who can you rely on and depend on, are we the right people? Is a CDMO or a CRO partner the right person or partner for the job? So it's become a complicated question as the field matures and we think more about being commercially ready, but also not having kind of that access to capital that would really allow us to build. So it becomes much more of a how to partner and what's the right way to think about getting to the market with something that is a viable process that's going to allow a viable business case for your company or your asset.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that long ago that people were paying $1 million for a slot a couple of years in the future to try and guarantee themselves a development or manufacturing slot. That I'm guessing that that kind of thing is an antiquated activity from a couple of years ago. But Adam, interested in your view.
I think that's right for today, right? The shift from pure capacity is a differentiator for a CDMO to now being experienced capacity is now the true thing, right? I mean, we've talked, I know Jeff and I have talked historically, and it's a prevailing theme, across all of the advanced therapies conferences about the expertise, right? And it's not just about getting people, it's about getting the right people who know what they're doing. And that's certainly still at a premium. And it's one of the biggest challenges that we have as we think about transitioning to a CDMO versus keeping the manufacturing process inside, internal is, we know our process, we think we can scale it versus once you do the tech transfer, there's always going to be hurdles with the tech transfer. And then you're inherently going to have to trust other people to do it for you. So I do think that is a chief concern as we think about, transferring over to a CDMO. I think the other thing is, as we think about the scaling and filling the facilities for internal manufacturing, a lot of the companies right now, it's either preclinical or early clinical stages, but you need to build a facility that is going to be able to accommodate late clinical or commercial batches in commercial scale. And so that inherently means that you're going to need a larger facility to be able to handle that. And it puts a large fixed cost, again, I think we mentioned it earlier, but if on these more or less smaller biopharma companies and being able to, handle those costs in the near term when the plant is operating at suboptimal efficiencies is a real struggle for these companies. So somehow developing a modular manufacturing facility that you can expand into as needed is really the secret weapon here. I just don't know that I've seen a lot of that, at least to date.
Yeah, no, a couple points there I wanted to highlight. So, as an enabling technology platform for manufacturing, obviously we're trying to close and automate, cell therapy manufacturing. And we partnered with people like GCON and GermFree, who in the modular clean room space to essentially offer a turnkey, modular manufacturing footprint. And our hope is that will help in this discussion to say, actually, maybe we could lease that space, or maybe we could buy it. We wouldn't have to buy, 100,000 square feet. You buy 1,000 square feet, and then you can kind of scale as you go, or scale as you reach your clinical milestones, or raise your additional round, or whatever it is, and give kind of de-risk that manufacturing investment decision as you get more and more proof points, be they clinical or commercial proof points. We've seen many of the cell therapy products when they launch, they start out relatively modest volumes, a couple hundred patients in the first couple of years, and then kind of moving into the thousands. But it's not, immediately you're trying to produce 10,000 doses. So this stepwise approach, not building out your capacity too far, because unused capacity is expensive, very expensive to operate and very expensive to build. So that's certainly a consideration. The other thing you mentioned, which I think is critical to highlight, is, therapy developers are looking for the right partner or partners to help them hit that next milestone, get into the clinic or get those clinical proof points, whatever it is. And our philosophy has always been to give them as much flexibility as possible. We don't want to close doors for them or lock them into certain things that they don't want to do or they don't want to, that's not their direction of travel. And in the past, technology providers haven't been that flexible. It's sort of, here's the system, here's how it works, take it or leave it, let us know if you have any problems. And we've spent a lot of time focused on flexibility, on how do we demonstrate the platform's capability in R&D or preclinical, or, you know, potentially in the clinical trial setting, or across cell types. You know, we've done work in CAR T and TIL and TCR, NK, dendritic cells, CD34s, like a whole bunch of different cell types that might encompass a larger part of your development portfolio, your pipeline, to say you don't want to spend a lot of time and a lot of money on a platform that's only going to work for a single program or only going to work for the next 3 years. And then I have to leave that platform to get to scale. These are the challenges that today are facing the industry. And, you know, when you combine that with a service offering, potentially, you know, you want not only best of breed technology as a therapy developer, you want to go with the people who have the knowledge and expertise. You know, this is what you said, Adam, which I think is 100% right. And going to, you know, those people that are experts, like, you know, CTMC or like, you know, Charles River, Elevate, or some of these other guys who really know deeply about cell therapy manufacturing. They want to be able to leverage the best in class, you know, whether it be services or technology. And by locking them out of that and forcing them to try, you know, either untested technology or service providers who don't have that depth of expertise, it's just cutting off their options. And so we've really tried to maintain flexibility, partner widely, lots of organizations. And we're thinking about a model called manufacturing as a service, effectively installing our platform in lots of different types of settings. So it might be an academic setting. Maybe it's like the cell and gene therapy catapult here in the UK. Maybe it's a CDMO partner site in the US, and allowing people to kind of transfer between those settings as their needs evolve. You know, if I need PD or R&D, I might go to a specialist, you know, CDMO to help me with that. Or if I want clinical manufacturing, maybe I'll go to MD Anderson. Maybe they'll help me with that because, you know, I want to be close to the patients. Or, you know, there's other ways to think about it. So flexibility is such an important point, retaining flexibility, because we don't really know. We don't know what challenges are going to come around the next month, the next, you know, next year. And locking yourself off from those opportunities can be costly, you know, as we've seen. You know, if you put $100 million in the ground into a facility that's a certain footprint, a certain design, certain set of capabilities in a certain location, 3 years before you get regulatory approval, you're severely limiting your options. I mean, and we've seen that really come back to bite several companies. And so, you know, really just kind of highlighting that flexibility point, absolutely critical. Jeff, I wanted to come to you on the next question just to say we're at the end of 2023, and it's been a big year for cell therapy. I think now we've had 8 approvals. We had a couple very recently in the sickle cell space, both Bluebird and Vertex CRISPR got approvals recently, and there's, you know, several thousand clinical trials happening currently. When you reflect back on 2023 for the cell and gene therapy industry, what do you see? You know, what were your biggest takeaways from the last 12 months?
Yeah, great question, Jason. Really worth looking back. I think 2023 will be looked back upon as a meaningful inflection point for the space. It was a very big year from an approval standpoint. And I really think it started to shift some of the questions that both patients and investors and developers are asking about the space, where we've kind of evolved from scientific and regulatory proof points, you know, questions like, what are your efficacy data? Can you actually get a regulatory approval in that indication? To questions around commercial viability of the business case for the system, for patients, for the healthcare system. Can we afford this? Why should I take this instead of a standard of therapy? How much should we pay for these drugs? How long do they last? What's the, you know, basically more around the commercial side of the question. So I think it's important to look back and take stock and be proud of the scientific advances and the number of regulatory approvals we've been able to get, particularly in a tough macroeconomic climate. So at the end of the day, we can look back and say a lot of the scientific promise has come to fruition. But the industry is now increasingly turning its eyes toward economics and commercial viability and making a business case and seeing are there going to be other billion-dollar franchises out there. In viral vector gene therapy, we've got Zolgensma in the AAV space as a billion-dollar franchise. I believe Yescarta from Kite crossed that line earlier this year in CAR T therapies with their second line approval in large B cell lymphomas last year. As a main driver there, so I think the industry is kind of looking for evidence of is there going to be another billion dollar asset in the cell and gene space. Who's it going to be? You can contrast that to someone like Bluebird, who does have, I think now it's a 4, I believe, globally approved drugs. But the market cap doesn't look anything like you would expect for a company with 4 approved drugs in the cell and gene therapy space. So that's kind of a critical question and a major inflection point that 2023 was. It used to be regulatory approval was kind of the goal. There was a little bit of a build it and they will come mentality, but now we're starting to realize that the space is going to have to drive access, drive reimbursement, drive patient uptake, just like any other biotech asset or company would have to think about it. But it's more complicated because these are obviously harder to make, more complicated and more sophisticated biologic drugs that are using mechanisms of action that are novel and are going to require some coaching and some teaching and market development and bringing providers and patients along on the journey about why these are good solutions. So that's kind of an overarching question or thought about the space. I think in cell therapy specifically, when you think about the state of play, many approved autologous CAR T therapeutics, we're looking still in hematologic cancer, still CD19 or BCMA. Is kind of the state of play on the commercial market. So I think in the open questions and kind of where I see interest and direction of travel for this space, big questions: how do we minimize vein to vein time? How do we keep our costs down so that as we climb lines of therapy, we can compete with a maturing pipeline of out of class competition? A lot of interest in the bispecific antibody world. Radiopharmaceuticals, ADCs have been white hot this year. A growing list of alternatives and out-of-class non-cell therapy competition as we climb lines of therapy and are trying to treat patients earlier and earlier. And then how do we move beyond heme? I think moving beyond heme, two directions of travel there. One, into solid tumor, again, major area of interest. More than 90% of cancer incidence is solid tumor, so much larger market opportunity, many more patients with significant unmet medical need in that space. Haven't really seen a silver bullet there, but a lot of great ideas and interesting approaches in the clinic. And the other major direction of travel is really orthogonal to oncology, and I would say into either autoimmune more broadly, as we recognize the role of B cells in things like lupus has been a pretty interesting early success story from some of the data, and other companies looking more broadly, things like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, and even into regenerative medicine, things like type 1 diabetes from Vertex, Parkinson's from Blue Rock, kind of another frontier for cell therapy. And then the third question, so you've kind of got, how do we, with what we have, how do we minimize the cost and vein-to-vein time in heme? How do we move beyond heme into either solid tumor or beyond oncology into regenerative medicine more broadly? And then third, how do we move, or can we move, beyond the autologous approach? It's a really high bar from a safety and certainly an efficacy and durability of response standpoint. Got, you know, the Emily Whitehead story with over a decade of remission. So the data are, the bar is quite high, but obviously the interest in allogeneic, both from a cost and manufacturing efficiency standpoint, and even into these kind of in vivo cell engineering approaches is something that has been interesting this year to look at. So those are kind of the three big questions, and in terms of where the field goes from there and what's being investigated in terms of areas of investigation for investment or areas of interest from the investor community and the developers we talk to, the design aspect of cell therapy. So the different cell types, different engineering approaches, to try to address the tumor heterogeneity, overcome immunosuppressive tumor microenvironment, improve cell infiltration into tissue. So all of that kind of what we'll call therapeutic design ethos is still a major investment theme and major area of interest. As I said earlier, no real silver bullet identified yet. I think one thing that's really important to call out is kind of, do we move beyond viral transduction as the way that we engineer T cells or cells for therapy writ large? I think two interesting developments more recently here that could be drivers. Obviously, the major approval for Vertex and CRISPR therapeutics in the SCD space. So using CRISPR edited therapies, so that's a huge approval milestone, and set some regulatory precedent for non-viral engineering in an FDA approved drug. the other side of the coin, you know, that's the carrot, the stick could be that the recently announced FDA investigation into T-cell malignancies and some of the early CAR T products. So you can make the case that that's probably an outgrowth of maybe some viral integration into an oncogenic gene driving some sort of malignancy. So being able to control where and how we integrate into the genome and how the edits take place could become a more important theme. So I think that moving beyond viral transduction is the second theme. So cell design, moving beyond viral transduction. And then third, it will always be, how do we reduce vein-to-vein time and reduce COGS? I think trying to reduce labor and risk of contamination, minimize unit operations by kind of boxing up more or all, as you guys are doing, of the workflow. Obviously, trying to streamline the process and minimize remanufacturing, reduce patient waiting, improve the robustness of these processes. And ultimately, we want to make these therapies cheaper, more affordable, so that we can unlock all the indications with the patients who need these innovations and make them all commercially viable, so that there's a reason for a company to go and develop a drug for all these patients in need.
Yeah, we can spend the rest of the podcast on picking that answer. There's so many golden nuggets in that. I want to hone in on, you just reiterated, which is great, the commercial viability question. You know, I think when we grew up, in those of us that grew up in small molecules and biologics, market access and manufacturing was basically assumed. It was sort of a given. You know, if you can make a product that's clinically effective, you'll be able to manufacture it and it will get covered. You know, maybe it might be third line instead of second line, or maybe it might be, you know, rather than preferred access on the formulary, it might not be, it could be non-preferred, but they're going to pay for it. And I think, you know, that sort of approach has carried us through the early phases of advanced therapy thinking around market access and commercialization. Now, we wouldn't be worrying about things like, you know, how are we going to make these things? How are we going to get to market until phase three? And you might be thinking about your market access strategy and, you know, how are we going to contract and those kinds of things. But you mentioned something really interesting, which I'm going to ask Adam to comment on, which is, manufacturers of advanced therapies have to be thinking about CMC from preclinical, from early stage R&D. I got to be thinking, how am I going to make a product that has, you know, meets my target cost of goods? Because I actually, in my old TPP in the small molecule world, I wouldn't even have had a cost of goods. It wouldn't even have been a consideration in my target product profile. But now I got to be thinking, how much is that this thing going to cost to make? What's my target indication? How many patients am I intending to treat in a given year? How am I going to make the product to suit the needs of those patient populations? And I have to do it all before I know, you know, before I'm in, you know, first in human, first in man, whether it works or not. Because otherwise, if I wait too long, if I wait post phase 1-2, then I'm stuffed. That's too late to fix it. And this is the problem that we've seen, and my biggest fear about some of the upcoming approvals, which we'll talk about in a minute, that we might see more of these products that are incredibly clinically effective, but we just can't make them. We can't get them to patients. Adam, I'd love to hear your view on that.
It's something that's a recurring theme and something that we hear about a lot, right? Where we say, oh, this product, it has a really old process and it's really expensive and just not efficient at all. There's not a straight path forward for it. But man, it is really, really effective, right? Mm. And so I do think that people are becoming more sophisticated, are starting to think a bit more, having more forethought to getting to an industrialized process sooner than later, right? It's certainly in the cards for them. It's just taking some time. I also think that for upcoming waves of technologies, that there is the potential to go back to the original process for some of these products and redo them. Right. I mean, there is a financial business case to be made for this, for sure. Right. If you're going to knock down your cost of goods by, I don't know, 10x, which, you know, seems exorbitant, but mm-hmm. certainly there's potential for that depending on the technologies. That's certainly something that you can make the case that this is a worthwhile investment and you're going to recoup those costs, because it's not just about you're going to improve your profit margins in the long term, but really I think in our eyes, by reducing the COGS, you're unlocking swaths of the patient population that can now have access to this, right? It's not just from a market access, but then also you can move from I don't know, academic medical centers to community settings. And it just, things will unlock, and you're also going to move from niche orphan diseases to perhaps more common ones. But you need to unlock those, the COG savings in order to do that.
As an aside, I mean, I heard the CEO of Legend Biotech present at Jefferies a month or so ago, and he said they were treating 30% of their clinical trial patients in CARTITUDE 4 or whatever follow-on trial they're doing for CARVYKTI outpatient. They're dosing them outpatient, which I thought was an incredible statistic, and just shows, you know, when you have a medicine that's incredibly clinically effective but also safe, you can really step down the level of expertise required to administer these products and to, you know, follow patients forward and really broaden access that way, which is a great step forward in my view. But if the product, to your point, if the product costs $500,000 or $1 million or whatever the number is, they're not going to allow you unfettered access at first line or second line. You know, they're going to keep you restricted. They're just financially, it's untenable for a lot of these payers to allow for first or second line access to products that are that expensive. So cost of goods or cost of manufacturing is a massive issue. I agree. I mean, we need to get costs under control. But I would argue it's not only for to improve the returns profile. It absolutely will do that. But I think ultimately these products, this is life or death. You know, Jeff used the words commercial viability. I think this is the difference between commercially viable, being commercially viable or not, is if you can't control your cost of goods and you have to charge a high price, you're going to be restricted. You're not going to be able to manufacture. You know, the access is just not going to be there. And so, you know, if you don't address this early, you know, okay, preclinical, that's ideal. But certainly during phase one, phase one, two, you have to address this issue. If you don't do it then, it's too late. And even with the most recent FDA guidance, they said, we want you to address manufacturing issues before you get into the clinic. Now, you know, everyone sort of scratched their head, like, how will we do that? Because today we're, you know, there's the old joke about process development begins when you hit the clinic and you start using, you know, patient cells, which is, you know, closer to the reality than any of us would like to admit. But, you know, how do we do that? And I think, you know, we need to, as a supporting, you know, enabling technology industry, to supporting therapy developers to make it easy for them to access technology, make, you know, make technology that's innovative, that allows them the flexibility they need. And I feel badly for some of these companies that are kind of caught in the middle where they're too far along potentially to stop and say, hey guys, time out. You know, we need to rethink this process. And they got to go to market with what they've got. And what they know probably deep down in their hearts, what they've got is not good enough to make the product widely available. But it's too, you know, it's too late to sort of go back and start over. But I would suggest, you know, for anyone that's earlier than phase three in their process, which the vast majority of the industry is, it's like 90% plus of the companies out there are earlier than phase three. Stop what you're doing and think immediately about your CMC and about your manufacturing and how to get to market at scale. Because, you know, we're seeing, you know, Autolus is coming to, should get an approval next year. Iovance, I think one of the, an Adaptimmune, two of the first TIL therapies, both addressing, well, at least one of them addressing solid tumors and melanoma. They're going to, it's trouble. Those are large indications. Those are challenging processes. And they're going to have trouble, I think, with the manufacturing, both getting enough volume out the door to treat any kind of large proportion of the patient population. But also they're going to struggle with high cost of goods. I think that's just, you know, we just kind of know that's going to be the case, unfortunately.
There's a multi-step process almost, right? It, you know, for those medium to late stage assets, it's really de-risking, showing that we can have the clinical effect that we think that we have, and it's safe and the like. And then there could be a re-examination of the process of how can we make this better? How can we reduce the COGS? The downside of that is, well, depending on your perspective, depending on how much you change, it could fundamentally become a different product, right? Which then could effectively restart your patent and IP clocks, right? And so it's not a, I guess, a zero-sum loss necessarily for the sponsor or the biopharma company. It's something that, honestly, you need to look into just to understand, you know, does the clock restart, or is it, am I just, you know, going to keep going forward and we're going to, you know, have competitors sooner than we think, right? So it's a tough thing. I think the other piece of it is, There's been a lot on the clinical benefits, and some of these, right? If you look at the Duchenne's drug from Sarepta, thinking about using surrogate endpoints, but are we really going to be able to demonstrate the clinical efficacy that's more increasingly required, especially for these high cost or high priced drugs or treatments, to be able to get access to patients and get reimbursement? And so how, you know, from a payer standpoint, you know, what else do we need to show in order to get that coverage, or from the manufacturing, can we reduce COGS so that way the scrutiny isn't as high on those clinical endpoints?
Do you guys have a view? So I've asked this question of a couple of folks that I know well. No one's ever tried to change fundamentally their manufacturing process once it's been approved commercially. And no one really knows how high the bar is. I mean, everyone thinks it's quite high. I mean, it's, you know, the perceived barriers or switching costs are very high. But I asked some experts, you know, former FDA staff, you know, people that worked in the in CBER and the kind of cell and gene therapy area, what they thought how high the bar might be, you know, if someone did want to fundamentally change their manufacturing process in various ways, maybe go to an automated platform when they've got a manual process, would that require a new pivotal trial? And I think universally their answer was no, we don't think so. But I wonder what you guys' view is, and I can fill you in a bit more about what they said they thought it might be. But I'm curious what your perception of this is, because it's uncharted territory, I think, for the industry.
I don't know the answer to that either, Jason. I would assume at least some sort of bridging study, you know, and obviously bioequivalence. But I think that there's fear of not only what it could entail, but there's especially if you think about who's trying to make that decision, it's probably somebody who's a franchise lead or a brand lead. Who would ultimately have to sign off on that decision. There's just perceived risk to the to the brand that they don't want to take on. I mean, they're owning the P&L for the brand. They don't want to take on all those costs, let alone the brand risk. So yeah. I think there's beyond the technical, hey, could we do this? There's some real considerations of should we, if you're you know, in charge of piloting that brand to success.
Yeah. I mean, I think the perception is parallel comparability study. Running existing process and new process side by side, running the same CQA release assays, et cetera, at the end to kind of ensure that you've got the same process. And then you have to dose, you know, X number of patients. Maybe they thought maybe 10 or 20. It wouldn't be a full, you know, full new clinical study, but just to demonstrate, again, safety and efficacy. But, you know, having to redo a pivotal and undertake a, you know, a 3-year effort and, you know, tens of millions to do that. It's just, you know, potentially too significant a hurdle when there's not, you know, significant momentum within an organization to do that. But you're seeing more and more. I mean, J&J, to use them as an example, they put a public statement and, you know, of their ambition out there. They said, you know, we want to be able to do 10,000 doses a year for Carvykti. You know, we want to be able to treat 10,000 patients a year in the next 5 years. And my guess is that they're really examining all their options here and trying to figure out how best to achieve that goal. And, you know, we've talked to other companies similarly, you know, with approved CAR T product that are thinking about not only tens of thousands, but, you know, how do I get to 30 or 50,000? You know, if I'm thinking about first or second line access, or I'm thinking about expanded indications for my product, you know, I need to be thinking at that scale. And they're actively considering these questions because ultimately, you know, they've realized that they've reached the rate limiting kind of step. They're at the ceiling of what they can do with their current process, and they need to rethink, you know, what they're up to.
The way I think about it is, if I wanted to draw a parallel, it would be toward not only, I think what happens is you have this first brand, this, you know, first mover in an indication, first in class type therapy, like what we see in today's CAR Ts. What's going to come next won't be, you know, what's going to replace it might not just be a anti-CD19 or anti-BCMA CAR T therapy, right? It might have a different targeting mechanism. It might be more specific. It will probably come with a different process that's hopefully much more efficient and easier to scale out. So I think I draw a parallel to, you know, in the antibody space. You had Humira as a major franchise for decades. TNF-alpha, now there's better mechanisms of action. They don't have to dose quite as frequently with like Skyrizi being the kind of fall, not, it's not the direct follow-on brand, but it's the evolution of the portfolio play in the immune indications for AbbVie. So I think that's probably what it will be for our cell and gene therapy developers, is there will be a next generation of products. Maybe it'll target similar indications, but it will be better both from a safety and efficacy standpoint, and certainly hopefully from a manufacturability and COGS profile, so that we can successfully treat tens of thousands of patients potentially.
It just begs the question, right? So I feel like there's a number of places where we solve something earlier in a value chain and then the bottleneck just shifts later, right? And so, yes, we need to solve the manufacturing. That's critical. I think right now, I think today we're thinking that it's going to be, I don't know, 6,000-7,000 patients are going to be treated within the United States with cell therapies this year. So to treat 10,000 patients is a monumental achievement, right? Which we should aspire to. But then the question goes to what we spoke earlier about with Legend, right? The 30% of their patients being treated in outpatient. I don't know how much you can overload UCSF or MD Anderson, right? Where you're going to have, you know, it's not only the current portfolio, you know, the current cell therapies that are being administered. Over the next 5-10 years, you're going to have tens more of these cell therapies being approved. And so you need to figure out how are we going to figure out the supply chain and patient flows, so that way the right patients get the right product at the right time. And so there's a whole ecosystem around that that also will need to be unraveled, and which is, I guess, a good problem to have, right? Is figure, you know, if you have enough product that is efficacious and safe and we can produce at scale, you know, let's figure out how to do the next steps.
Yeah. I think Jeff made a point that I wanted to just go back to, which was, you know, we are in the golden age of biotech and biology, or synthetic biology and AI and drug discovery, and all these tools are emerging that will help us, you know, discover new targets and treat disease in ways that we haven't even conceived of yet. And this is all happening around us, which is fantastic from a human perspective. From a cell and gene industry perspective, I think it's important that we recognize that, you know, this is not the only area of innovation happening. You know, you look at ADCs or antibody drug conjugates and these other areas that are really emerging, bispecifics, and they're targeting many of the same indications. They're targeting multiple myeloma. They're targeting other areas that, and if it can be, even if it's not curative, like some of our cell therapies are suggesting they can be, we need to think about, you know, commercial viability in the context of the full range of the competitive set. And that's, you know, if you've got an ADC that's going to cost $50,000 and we're trying to charge $450,000, we're going to struggle. You know, even if we're slightly more efficacious or slightly more safe, or and so again, addressing this, you know, we're not special, unfortunately. You know, just because we're in a cell therapy, we can charge, you know, $400,000 versus other products that are, you know, 10% the cost or something like that. We need to think about this in the round, you know, and across the spectrum to make sure that we're, because ultimately what all of us are trying to do is to get patients access to these therapies. That's the reason why we're developing them. That's the reason why we're talking today. And, you know, the worst case scenario is, you know, what we saw with Zynteglo in Europe and 7 or 8 other gene therapies that were launched, couldn't quite get the commercial traction, couldn't quite get market access. They'd already spent the money to develop the product. They've already spent the money on the regulatory approval process. They'd already spent the money to launch the product. And patients were anxiously waiting for it and wanting to get the benefits. But then the economic question couldn't be answered. And so everyone has to backpedal and backtrack. It's bad for patients, bad for companies, bad for regulators, bad for health systems. And that's the worst case, is if we don't plan for this early enough, if we don't address the manufacturing and the cost of goods and the, how we're going to get to market and commercial viability from the very beginning, we're driving, you know, we're sort of developing to a dead end. We're never going to get to where we want to get to. We're never going to get to that ROI and to get the kind of patient impact that all of us have been working towards. And I think that's the worst case scenario. That's the ultimate, you know, worst case. It's not that actually the product fails in the clinic, because that happens all the time. That's part of science. It's part of, you know, working in biology. The worst case scenario is having it succeed in the clinic, but then fail to get market access and to treat new patients.
then investors see that, right? And yeah. and then there's some pretty big headwinds of, well, can we overcome this? And will the next one actually be get commercial traction? So yeah, I couldn't agree more. And again, I think people are starting to be a bit more sophisticated with this and be more forward thinking. But it's not everybody. And it's certainly the problem we're going to have is the next wave of approvals, for the most part, are built on legacy,
first generation
processes, even if it's second, but you get my point. So yes, it's a challenge.
And is this I think part of this, I invest in companies as well as operating in one, so I can beat myself with the same self-flagellation mechanism, whatever that is. But do you think investors really get it? Because I think the investment community has had a playbook that has worked for 30 years in small molecules and biologics, and it's not working anymore. And human beings are hard to change. The way we think about these things are hard to change. You would think if investors were telling their development teams and there's early stage biotechs, like, guys, I understand if it's going to take you another 6 months to sort your commercial process or your manufacturing process out, and we're going to be 6 months later in the clinic than you said, that's okay. I think it's worth the investment of time now to get that right. I don't see a lot of companies behaving as though their boards and investors are saying those things to them.
I would agree. I think there's select pockets of them, of companies and investors that are, right? It's frankly, it's probably the ones that have been burned by this maybe already, yeah. Right? And so it's I think it's a slow growing minority that acts like this. I can tell you right now, we're advising a client on this exact issue of how do we think about the manufacturing process? How do we think about our manufacturing strategy to continue to develop our portfolio of products? And the board is mixed on, or not at least not hearing their internal manufacturing folks saying, hey, we need to think about this sooner than later. And hence, that's where, we're providing some support and really laying out the issues at hand and providing some of a fact base to make an informed decision about it.
Yeah. Well, anyone who listens to this podcast is going to be tired of hearing me say the phrase, but we are racing to create therapies that are approvable, but they're not affordable or accessible. And that, is ultimately where we're going. And a lot of it has to do with investors and boards that are pushing teams to get into the clinic, get first in man as fast as possible. And that old model, I just wrote an article on this in Cell and Gene, the old model of getting taken out at phase two because you had good clinical data, it's gone. It's just not happening anymore, not in advanced therapies. We need a clear path to commercial viability. We need a clear path to market to deliver an ROI. And people are willing to wait. Big pharma is willing to wait to see, do you have a credible story of how to get there? Or can you just plug into potentially our infrastructure to make a synergy that makes sense? But, I think that old playbook needs to be, put to the side, and we need to develop a new one for advanced therapies. I had spoken to the CEO of a company working in autoimmune, and these are big indications. I mean, lupus itself is like, Jeff mentioned, is like 50,000 patients a year, maybe 10x what ALL is currently, or 5x rather, what ALL is currently. And they're, being pressured by their board to rush into the clinic and get clinical data. That's the milestone everybody wants to see. No one's stopping to ask the question of how are we going to make these things? How are we going to make them available? Especially in a big indication like that. And, I think we're running against that same old definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And so we need to, as an industry, I think, really question some of the key assumptions, and starts with investors, starts with boards, starts with, leadership teams. This is not universal. There are lots of companies that are thinking about this, but you just think there needs to be more of it. There needs to be more people thinking in this way to ensure that those products make it to patients and really have the impact that they could potentially have. I was reading an article this morning about, using CAR T in lupus, and they tried it on one patient who had incredible results. I think she was still in remission 3 years later. And they tried it on 14 more patients and all of them are in remission. You know, it's just like people need these products, but we need to be able to, you know, having a cure for cancer or rare disease that people can't get access to is useless. You know, it's not what we do. So let me end the podcast today, if you don't mind, but just asking, you know, from each of your viewpoints, what's your outlook for the sector in 2024? We talked about 2023 being this really kind of pivotal year when we started to think about at scale these issues around manufacturing and commercial viability and cost of goods and all, and really kind of that issue became very, very crystal clear, I think, in 2023. Maybe Jeff, I'll start with you and just ask what's your outlook for 24? Maybe the kind of short, you know, 1 to 3 year outlook. What does success look like for the industry from your perspective?
We just kind of synthesize the challenges that we talked about that I think are going to persist. So the three of those, one is commercial uptake, commercial ramp, still going to be eyes out looking for that next $1 billion asset in cell and gene therapy space and continuing to collect that real world evidence and data and build more and more of a convincing case about the safety, efficacy, and clinical impact on patients of these products. Two is the tension between the recognized need for earlier investment in process, in manufacturing, in how you design the trial and collect the data and do you surrogate versus outcomes-based markers or endpoints. And then the headwind from the current macroeconomic and biopharma funding environment, which is I mean, to contextualize it, we're kind of where we were pre-pandemic in terms of biopharma funding. It had a big kind of peak in early 21, had a 6-quarter slide, and then it's kind of recovered and been flattish for the last 4 quarters. So steady, but not frothy like it was in 2020, 2021. So tension between the need for investment and all these factors that we're talking about with the economic reality of asking people to wait 6 more months and redesign the process. They might not have the cash on their runway to do that. And they certainly don't necessarily have the access to raise the capital that they would have 2 years ago. And then the how to build question. And do you yourself? Do you partner with the CDMO? Do you, if you're J&J, do you go to Novartis? So how to make are kind of the three big questions that I think the industry will be teasing out and working against in 2024. So those are what I've got my eyes out on for the next year or two. Interesting to hear what Adam's got on his list.
I mean, I agree with Jeff's points. I think one of the things that was something that we talked about a lot on that, you know, for the past hour or so was this decentralization of patient care. And I do think, and this is not going to happen necessarily in 24, but as we move forward into the next 3 years, even, you see a lot of the big distributors, right? McKesson's, AmerisourceBergen, Cardinal Health, that are really listing cell and gene therapy as a core tenant of their strategies moving forward. And so how can they help shape the landscape of patient care within cell and gene therapy, I think is going to be an important consideration for us. You know, it will require a bit more interplay between the manufacturers, the biopharmas, and, you know, the distributors of the world. But it's certainly something that, again, could certainly improve patient access to therapies.
I mean, it's focused on that affordability and accessibility question. And that's ultimately determined by, as you said, clinicians, patients, payers. You know, if I'm a clinician and I'm going to prescribe a product for my patient, am I going to do the one that I know I can get access to for them and I know I can do it in a timely fashion, or one that I might have to wait, may not be able to get access to? These are very relevant. You know, they may not be able to have a manufacturing slot. They may not be able to get the product back in time for the patient. You know, 25% of patients pass away on the waiting list. So these are, you know, pretty sobering statistics that, you know, really should focus our attention on solving these kinds of challenges as a primary focus. Well, on that note, we will end this discussion. And thanks so much to both of you for sharing your insights. It sounds like 2024 from all perspectives is going to be a busy one for guys like us that are trying to help companies solve these problems and to bring these incredible products to patients at scale. So thanks to both of you and look forward to seeing you both again soon.
No, thank you, Jason. Yeah, 2024 should be a good year. A lot to do, a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, thanks, Jason, again, for the invitation to come chat. really inspiring conversation. Really helps me think about focusing on the mission, staying grounded in the patients, their families, their needs. We're working toward a really powerful cause here, improving patients' health and their quality of life. And even though things are challenging right now, it's really energizing to focus on that and all the impact we can have. So thanks again for the great discussion.
Absolutely. Thanks both.
Thank you for listening to the Ori Spotlight podcast. To keep up with the latest in cell and gene therapy and follow us on our mission to manufacture brighter futures for patients, head to the show notes to follow us on social media or visit us at oribiotech.com.